problem with this venue. The only problem with this venue is I assume you can all see very well. Am I correct? Yes. Well, it's not that clear to me, but fortunately we've also got the hard copies. So that's very helpful. And what we're going to do, you can see from a hard copy, if I can get mine in front of me, and we'll open up properly in a minute, you'll see all different colours. I want to make you to all make sure you've got all the documents, because it's that kind of meeting. Make sure you've got your constitution, your committee rules as a base. Then the bill.
And then also make sure you've got the heavy duty package, so that we're going to go through this very carefully. That anyone who's been on the committee, it is a time where you really have to focus. Because now is the time to say yay or nay. Not adopt, but you know, really come in. I was on my way to say hello to you, advocate. And I never quite got there. Hello. It's good to see everyone here, including the state law advisors and parliamentary legal advisors and tonight. So now let's go back to the agenda. Go to the protesters.
Right, good morning. We on to a heavy program on Tuesday. Currently it is still called the Promotion and Protection of Investment Bill. And we've got some apologies here. Before we, one of the apologies does affect us quite seriously. The apology is the Honourable Vlaco. He did indicate yesterday he was visiting the doctor at 3 o'clock yesterday, and he'll be away today until Tuesday or Monday, and then rejoin the committee on Tuesday. But he's well on top of this bill, that's Honourable Vlaco. We are going to try and make some official inquiries now, not personal, about the Honourable Mantash, because we were under the impression she'd be joining us at the end of October. So we'll make an official inquiry in that regard. Those are the two apologies I have. What are the others? Well, if the apologies aren't here by 9:15, these marked people absent. All right? We have no other apologies. As you know, the meeting here is Honourable Mkongi.
I'm not sure what they told me to check this in. I'm sorry. I'm not going to be able to do anything because it's hot here. And I can't
hear you. Too.
I'm saying I can't count it because it's very hot here. I don't know whether some people can do this.
I think the secretary has already made me aware of that problem. I was thinking of taking off my own blouse, but I didn't think it would look very good. So I have also made my own serious inquiries in that regard. Okay, so are we doing something other than trying to grapple with the window that won't open? All right, they are. So let us all just press on quietly. And in fact, what do they say to you? Very hot, be very still. Just get your mouth to open. adoption of the agenda. Just before we adopt the agenda, I want some advice from you, Mr. Hermans. I'm under the impression this meeting was ending at 2. Oh, the house was sitting at 2. Right. Thank you. Okay. No, no, that's just to get the vision of things. At about 10:30, I hope everyone's listening, we will be breaking for a short time. I'm really informing the DTI about this, so that we can elect a new an acting chair. I think you're all aware of that. Thank you. Right, now to have the adoption of the agenda, we'll try and finish at 1:20, court calls to enable you to get to the house. We please have someone to propose the adoption of the agenda. Thank you, Honourable William. Seconded by the
well, I was just in discussion with Mr. Kurinov. The house is sitting at 2 today, so I think it would only be right for us then to end at 1, because we still, before we get to the house, so to end at 1:30 is going to be a bit late.
You didn't hear what I was saying.
No,
I think you were trying to press. Yeah, that's exactly. I said, well, given that the house is finishing, is starting at 2, we may need to finish before that, even before 1:40. So we'll try and finish as soon after 1 on a note. I pass 1 on a clock at the end of whatever we're doing just at that moment. 4:52 for that matter. I was just making that point. Can we ask someone to second the adoption? Thank you, Honourable MacPherson. Right. Now, we'd like to welcome the DG, Salon October, the DDG, International Trade and Economic Development, ITEC, Mr. Ntombi Peter, then Mr. Dagama, all the way, Mr. Dagama, from Geneva. Right. Director, ITED, Mr. Mene, Director ITED, Mr. Connor, Assistant Director. See, it's written as Mr. here. Mr. M. Right, Advocate Stradham. Thank you very much. And of course, we've indicated Ms. Ian Gamer as well as Advocate Williams. Thank you very much. Let's get started. In front of you, we've got you've got 2 documents. The larger document is in green, black, green, and red, and it indicates that the text indicated in green relates to amendment agreed only in principle. Do you understand that? Only in principle, right? And the text indicating red relates to proposed amendments not agreed to. Now, those are the ones we should really be looking at. And I'm also looking at our legal people who assist us in this regard. The Minister of Trade and Industry is BATC 2015, and on the right hand side we have the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry for consideration only draft amendments. And you've then got the actual draft amendments. You see them there, and they're color-coded the same. Mr. Hermans has just handed me this morning something called the Anglo-American South Africa Limited Supplementary Written Submission to the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry on the Promotion and Protection of Investment Bill 2015, dated the 23rd of September. Mr. Hermans has indicated to me the reason we've got it now is that indeed that was after closing date of submissions. And nevertheless, we've always allowed for a day or two in the past, we've allowed consideration of it. Does everyone have a copy? Does everyone have a copy?
No.
Please, Mr. Williamson. Right. Everyone else? Does everyone else have a copy?
No.
Well, we've got members from DTI who are actually requiring this. Thank you. That's right, okay. don't know how they came. Right, so our advice then to DTI, DG and DDG is that you look at this, you know what you've been adding here. If it is something fundamentally different, do let us hear it. Members, read it. If in your opinion there is something fundamentally different and additional, note it. Not today per se, because you haven't had a chance to read it, but next week. Right. Okay, so we've got the bill in front of us now. We're going to get very systematically on this bill. Page one, that's the front page. The front page there. On page one, I'm working both with this one here, plus. We're working with three documents. Does everyone care about that? No. To omit, remember what green is? In principle, we've agreed. Promotion and. If I don't see a hand being raised, it means you continue to agree in principle. All right? Long title. Page in red here. Page one. On page two, in the first line of the long title, to omit legislative. To provide, do you see that mini preamble, as it were? To provide for the protection. Do you see that? Now, it puzzles me here that in doing so, to provide for the protection, the number one is the first title, and it's legislative. In green, the first and second line of the long title to omit the words the protection and promotion of and substitute the. So what we should be looking at then is to provide for, to provide investors, you see you've got to provide for here. You've got a four stop. And I think there's some mini errors here. Yes, advocate strike.
But it's here 5 feet too early for me to speak, but just allow me very briefly. If we refer to the so-called A bill, or what we call the A list, which is the list containing the actual proposed amendments, it makes in a way for unfriendly and unkind reading. So might I suggest that in dealing with the A-list, as we reflect on the actual amendments there, that we immediately refer to what is called the draft B-bill, which is the bill incorporating the amendment that we find in the A-list into the introduced bill that has from the onset been serving for this committee. So to make them for the easier reading, if we deal with an amendment that you just referred to, that is there, it would then read as we find it in the draft B bill. The draft B bill is the one containing the little note right at the top as to the color coding. And there we find it then in the long title, just before the preamble on page 2 of the B bill, to provide for the protection of investors and their investment. This is in a sense consequential to the change in the long title, or the short title, of the bill as well, where the word promotion has been deleted. And then here we find protection, and the one pertaining to investors and merely broadening the wording there, saying that it does not only apply to investors, but specifically to their investments. So in the reading in the people that is here, the way I see it, there is no difficulty there with respect.
Well, Benefit, can you read that
three
lines? The DPI are proposing it should be.
So should the amendment be adopted by this committee, it would be to provide for the protection of investors and their investments. It's the very first line of the long title. It's on page 2, right at the top of the draft deal.
Yeah. Everything was mentioned. I'm not going to mention it. The same thing. The speed reading without this? Yes. The readers aren't there?
Without there. To provide the perfect protection of industry and investment.
Investment.
But yeah, they now need to do it again. Yeah. Investment. So they say invest.
That's fine. It's just that at the moment the red is a proposal. That will be fine to verify. The green we've all agreed to. We understand that.
Madam Chair, and then I'm done for the time being. May I also just refer to the fact that unfortunately, in this draft people, we do not have the benefit of the lines, the line numbers, as we find in the introduced bill. But because that is a securitized document, we can't fiddle with it, so we fabricated this draft people, but it hasn't got the benefit of the lines.
I won't use the word fabricated. I would say simply that technically you've produced a document without the relevant line notation. You're the last person to fabricate. Right, Honourable Elvis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to clarify something. On the first page of the D-Bolt, you would note that at the top of that page it's text indicated in the green, both in amendments of each in principle, and then below it, text indicated in red, that's to correct the amendments and not a breach. And then line on the top of page 2 says to provide for the protection, so the protection is not agreed to according to this logic.
That's what I was making the point.
So that makes sense.
You know, it may not make sense, but they can't assume what's in our head, and we need to make sense out of it. We have not, they are saying, look, they agree with us. We need to remove that. That's what they're proposing, alright?
So, to remove the word protection, so that they think the problem they see.
The legislature. No, it does. This is what got me at first. But allow him to read it as they are proposing, alright?
So they will...
They'll read it one small time as they are proposing.
Madam, see, I apologize. This has given rise to confusion. All that we're saying is that what we find in red in the Bible, except proposed amendments that have been discussed in this committee and maybe to a large extent agreed upon, but not in the formal sense of the word. That is why we indicate them in red. As opposed to the green ones, where according to our humble opinion, there has been broad kind of agreement in the committee as to that.
I think, you know, as with its freedom, it's simply trying to stick to the legal position here. Green, we have agreed to in principle in a very formal manner. We haven't, the red, that's all he's saying. We've discussed it here and there, but we haven't actually agreed to it. We must now agree to it formally. Do you see, Honourable Albert? And it's not just you. I also would... have or get rid of. So what we're saying is we want this retained in black. Am I right? All of it in black. We're agreeing to the protection. Am I right? Yes. Right. To provide, those will now read, and the committee agrees to provide for the protection of investment and the investment. You know, what do they say, LBW, I don't know what that one was. Yeah. Some strange thing, googly ball here. All right, now we're moving ahead. Who has a hand? Someone? Mr. DeGarner.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry for coming back. I think it's quite logical the concern that the members raised, because if one looks at the long title on the A list, one sees the proposal is to omit legislative. So what has happened is that legislative has been omitted, but I think an imperfect translation of this then essentially highlighted the protection, which has always been there. So the word that's been deleted is essentially legislative. The protection should not be in red because that has always been in the bill.
So, but we appreciate just that additional piece of information, but the reality is it will remain now to provide for the protection of investors and their investment. Are we all on track?
Yep.
Right. It's good if you you say so, because unfortunately Hansard is not yet on video. Okay, so it does want noises. Preamble. Conscious. Right, let's just look at that. We don't see here in the B on page 2 anything in green or black. That's page 2. But what we're looking at here on the these little extras here on page 2, the terminology of conscious to omit need and the substitute obligation. And there we are, we have got a little green one, conscious of the obligation, that's been agreed to. That has been agreed to. Right. I think very faint green there, eh? And then we're coming again to terminology of considering on page 2, to the terminology of considering to omit promotion of. So you have here the protection. That's simply consequential now. Do you see that? And that is it. Am I right? Page 2. Everyone agrees? Page 3. Page 3, emphasizing. And on page 3, everything there is in green. And the terminology, right to justice, etc., etc. So what the agreed in principle is emphasizing the rights related to access to just administrative action, access to justice, access to information, and all other rights set off in the Bill of Rights. I wondered if it would retain its legal meaning. I'm looking at the lawyers now. If we say the rights, emphasizing the rights related to access to colon, just administrative action, semicolon, justice, semicolon, information, and all other rights. Instead of saying access to, you know, advocate Simon?
Madam Chair, this would clearly be in a matter of style and garden. I've got no qualms whatsoever.
No, do you agree? It's just a semantic issue there. And then the second one, recognizing the obligations. Recognizing to omit need and substitute obligation. Right. Now, acknowledging is in red here, the issue, that investment must be protected. They are proposing that this is retained there in red to omit promoted, in the terminology of acknowledging, to omit promoted and encouraged. The investment must be protected in accordance with the law. Now that was in, not in principle, so we now need on the mic, just indicate that you agree. That's what in principle means.
Right.
Chairperson, I agree with this.
Everyone agrees? Right. Then we move down at the whole of page 3. Then we go to page 4. Someone's cheering. Parliamentary legal advisor. Right.
Thank you, Chair. Doesn't it pass that maybe we look at Desireas as well, the terminology for Desireas, because it seems that the promote investment, and then let her have to be
on
the preamble. At page 2, see the preamble.
Alright, now that we're all back on page 2, just say that again, please.
That one, focusing on Desireas of promoting investment by creating an environment that facilitates processes that may affect investment. So what you still have promoting there, and we maybe a suggestion that we change that to relate to
thank you, Madam Chair. I think we note the intervention by the Parliamentary Legal Advisor, but I think in a broad sense, this bill also intends to promote investment in a particular kind of way by setting a legal framework. So I think in the preamble, it is correct to reflect the subsidiary intention. It may not be the main intention. The main intention is to protect, but as subsidiary outcome and consideration, we believe that retaining a reference to promotion would be the right thing to do. Thank you. Okay.
Yes, I'd like to hear from the committee on this item. I would certainly go along with that, but let's hear what you think. Let's hear what you think.
Honourable
Colonel.
Chairperson, I think it's fair.
Are we all agreed? I look at the DA as well. Right. On the parson at the back here now. Can't actually see you. Right. Okay. So we're going to move. We're going to retain that. And you, Ms. Ngema, would you go along with that?
Yes.
Fine, thank you. And then we go to page 3, which we've done. Everyone was okay with that. Page 4. Page 4. We also, of course, we're looking at the arrangement of sections. All right, the arrangement of sections, when you're going through them, I'm just also trying to keep in touch with my main bill here. Right. It's on page 3 of the earlier bill A, and then page 4 on B. We see 1, 2, 5. Right. Does someone have a hand up? 1 to 5. Yes, Mr. Dharma?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Our comment is pertaining to 6, which deals with establishment. So if we look at a logical reading of the bill, the title as found in the current draft should then change from rapid establishment to establishment. But that we'll get to in the subsequent reading, just to indicate that may be something that we need to look at.
Right. Mr. Williams?
Honourable Williams?
Thanks, Chairperson. Chairperson, this section we're looking at, surely we can move past this section when we get to the sections it's referring to and we change the names there, then this will automatically vanish.
Everyone all right with this?
At this point. Right? We move faster. We then move to the B, page 4, page 5. And that's definitions. It's page 3 of the A bill here, page 5 here, and looking at that. Right. Now we're on the definitions. And this acts on this context in case otherwise. First two are fine, we come to green dispute. We've agreed with this in principle. We thought the department means the department responsible for trade and industry. Dispute means a claim, but this lot, people have agreed in principle to that green, section 12, that the government has allegedly breached the protection provided for in this act. And then several blacks, and then we come to measure. Again, something we've agreed to in principle refers to binding government action directly affecting an investor or in its investment and includes laws, regulations, and admin actions. We go to this act. Yes, Honourable Mkongi?
Sorry. First thing when you present in 26, the process of discussion, you embrace issues of principle. One of them, you said, the green will mean that those are issues that are agreed upon in principle, and then the red might be controversial issues. Now, I don't think it's going to be necessary for us to leave the green part, because we are agreed upon, we're going to concentrate on red. I thought that was green.
I think you need to check it. It's going to be the first time we've had errors. So check it along, okay, this act, checker there, blind to everything, going to B, age 6B, investment. You'll see the numbering. I'm not going to refer to the numbering, of course, because that is simply consequential as it moves along. But C. Now, C is a very large area, and you do need to look at that. You really do. So, on page 6, the holding, make sure you've got all your copies up here, investment C. The holding, acquisition, or merger by such an enterprise with another enterprise outside the Republic, to the extent that such holding, acquisition, or merger with another enterprise outside the Republic, comma, have an effect on an investment contemplated by 2A and B of this Act in the Republic. Now, I'm just looking to ensure, I'm asking legal advisors, is this numbering now correct in the green?
Unless somebody objects, Madam Chair, maybe from special advisors, but I think the numbering is correct. It starts with 2, then subsection 1, and then paragraph A, B, C, and then there's a new insertion in subsection 2, same thing again, paragraph A, B, C, D, E, and F. I think that is the sequence, Madam Chair.
Right. The only reason I'm raising that is because at the top of page 6, you note 2 in brackets 1.
That is purely called the new insertion of another subsection, being in subsection 2. So the force cannot remain 2.
No, that's what it
is. It's a technical.
So you'll deal with that in due course.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. We all on track. And then we go to reading in green. For the purposes of this definition, an enterprise may possess assets as inter alia. When are we going to change this phrase inter alia? I see they changed it in Canada.
A
real be lost.
We're well aware that we should not be using Latin terminology.
Please do not use inter alia.
I apologize.
See, people don't even know what it means. Now that's got to tell you something. Because we took a decision in 94, re-emphasized in 95 and 96, that we will use accessible language unless such accessible language makes a fool of the law. And I don't see that will talk in plain English. I've heard so much about the inter alia. Never mind. Ship as defined by the company act. Dividend, exemption, stocks, debentures, security as defined in the finance mark, financial markets act. Other equity instruments of the enterprise or another enterprise. Then goes on to B, a debt security of another enterprise, C, loans to an enterprise, D, movable or immovable property, and other property rights such as mortgages, liens, or pledges. Just for the benefit of everyone, we do leave lien in here. It's a very old English thing. What does it mean?
I hope that it's not falling to the Latin category as well, Madam Chair. A lien is, I'll be really brief, a lien is simply a right of retention. If we request a builder to build extensions to a house and those extensions have been completed and he or she would seek payment and we failed to pay, he or she would be entitled to retain that portion of the house that has been extended. It is a right of retention. If it's a Latin word, we will rectify that as well. I doubt that it's
not Latin.
I offered my apology, Madam Chair. Thank you.
It's English. Yes.
No, I just wanted to know, why do we have to use difficult English? I mean, why do we have to do that? Because this thing is no, no, no. If you take a person from a township, you must explain for 2 days that is yes. Because this thing is not only red color. But why do we use, you know?
Yes.
Why do we have to use difficult English?
Well, I think I'll note that for further discussion, but it is English, and a lot of, you know, we may want to say the level of English, what we want to use, and we do need that discussion at some point in Parliament, at some point. All right. E, claims to money or any performance under contract having a financial value. Copyright, know-how. Good Lord, is know-how not a hyphenated, isn't it? It's one word, isn't it? Goodwill, industrial property rights such as patents, trademarks, industrial designs, and trademark names, to the extent that they are recognized under the law of South Africa. Just as a matter of interest, I notice that sometimes we use the phrase South Africa. Most of the time we use the word republic. You know, that just sort of to ring the changes. No, can you see that? You know, I mean, there's no real reason for it. Yes, Honourable Mkongi.
I think there is reason not to be critical yet. Maybe the political reason why South Africa is a part of the South Africa is not a United what or something. It's a republic. So that, and the ego not to understand. We must find ourselves diverting from the COP program that we established the Republic. So I suggest that we should be consistent of using the Republic of South Africa and just saying South Africa.
I noticed that in the definitions we've got the word republic, and we know that it does mean South Africa. So let us just, what does the Constitution say?
Madam Chair, I'm talking way too much at this point in time. We must be guided by the very first word that we find in the Constitution, the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa. And to the best of my knowledge, we've been adhering to that. We will simply
Let us go in that direction, and we do appreciate your cooperation. Right. Returns, page 7, such as profit, dividends, royalties, income yielded by an investment or rights or concessions conferred by law under contract, including licenses to cultivate, extract, or exploit natural resources. I'd like to ask just one question. I noticed that along most of these, you've said or, the term is or this, or that, or this, or that. Can we not have both? I'm just looking here, to look at both here. Returns such as profits, etc., and rights or concessions. Is that never going to arise? It's a question, really, I don't know.
Madam Chair, unfortunately, the difference between the words or and in legislation, there can be a huge discrepancy when it comes to interpretation.
But I can't hear and slash or. That's what I'm asking. No,
Madam Chair.
I mean, everyone who's all the legal findings agree.
Yeah. We must select either and or. And then the consequences are vastly different. Like here where we mention all the kinds of assets that might be classified in terms of this act as investment, there might be an or. Of course, any one of those assets will fall into the category of investment. Whereas if the word had been and, it would have meant that in order to classify as an investment, you would have had to have all these assets, which definitely could not be.
Right, no, I think you've given me a satisfactory explanation. I'm satisfied. Interpretation of the Act, page 7. The actual aid bill, that's page 4. Interpretation. And that's 2 or 3, right. All right, we're all on track. We've got red. Now that means we must focus. We've discussed it. We haven't fully agreed. under interpretation of the Act, the Constitution, 3B, including Romans Moore I, the interpretation of the Bill of Rights. The interpretation of the Bill of Rights contemplating section 39 of the Constitution. 39 of the Constitution. I wonder how many people know the Constitution off the heart. Looking for smart Alex. Right, 39. I've got it, yes, right. Are you all there? You've seen the interpretation. Do we have a problem? Let's have, yes, Honourable Nkongi.
No, I don't have a problem. I was just checking from the beginning of the speech. It's our first time to refer to the Constitution. It's in page 7, isn't it? We didn't refer to the Constitution in all from page 1 up to page 7.
I
was just trying to peruse through. I don't see that we have
We have in fact a number of
Right, okay. Now that's fine. We must all be quite comfortable. Right, can we hear from anyone? What about the DA? Are you happy with that read? Can we now agree in principle? How about putting a little bit on the mic, then, especially when you do agree?
If you have to agree
on mic, this is the thing, if it's to go to me.
We agree.
There we are. Right, now let's go to the four. Purpose of the Act is to A, protect investments. And I'm looking to see what we originally had there. Purpose of the Act. Right. We all agree there. Let's have a yes. William, Honourable William?
Agreed,
Now, I'd also like to hear the voices of some of the other parties as well. This is an important bill, whether you agree or not. The red is important in principle. Then we've moved. We go to page 8. B. Confirm the protection of investments in respect of national treatment and physical security of property. All right. Do you see that, B? Confirm the protection of investments, the plural, in respect of national treatment and the security of investment. And what you recall that was before, it said, and the security, we've noted now, and the physical security of investment. Now that is something, if I'm not mistaken, that was raised by the DA, according to my own notes. That an example was given about what do we mean by security,
Yes.
If you could just comment.
Yeah, with regard to physical security, I agree, but I still don't think that that sentence is adequate. I would prefer to just leave it as confirm the protection of investments. Because you see, when you specify in respect of national treatment and physical security of property, it's limited to those two things only. And the debate is whether those two things are sufficient or whether there's a need for additional. That is a matter still under debate. So I don't think we should specify that we're only referring to national treatment and physical security. Let's just say confirm the protection of investments.
You don't want to move beyond
in respect of national development. No, I don't want to move beyond investments. I'm doing
the
protection
of investments.
All right,
let's have
that on record, Honourable
William.
Jefferson,
we agree
with
Gail. The policy, I want to look at whether it is still required to have B then, because in A, they are saying the purpose of the Act is to protect investments in accordance with and subject to the Constitution. And again, in B, I think concerns the protection of investment. So maybe there needs to delete B then, because it's already covered in
B. All right, that is a proposal from the DTI. Can we have an agreement or what? Yes, Honourable William.
Jefferson, we agree with that proposal that we remove that section B.
We agree.
Right, so we have an agreement here. Right, and also Honourable Ellis agrees that we're now deleting B, we're amending that. All right? And we move, I hope we've got a bill this time. But see, affirm the Republic's sovereign right to renegotiate, sorry, to regulate, I've got negotiations on the brain, affirm the Republic's sovereign right to regulate investments. Now we've got green, which means we agree to that in the public interest. Honourable Williams?
Can we agree with that?
Everyone agreeing what? And then you have D, another in principle contain the Bill of Rights in the Constitution and the laws that apply to all investors and their investments in the Republic. Just a minute. Sorry, just on this page 8D, right, we were just concluding that last line and their investments in the Republic. And it was in principle agreed, and I see you still remain on board. Now, the application of the Act, we have some comment here, which you may well have this, I hope you do. It's from the Department, no, that's not from the... That's from the legal advisor, Ms. Ngema, dated the 2nd of October, Parliament, particularly on that subject, meaning an implication of using term lawful, as suggested in Clause 5 of the Promotion Protection of Investment Act. Have you all got this? You should. Please get it up. Right. Is that Advocate Williams?
I thought we read it. No, it's fine. Then we did it.
We don't know that's you.
All right. Mr. Williams, will you please, this is important. It's a legal opinion. Everyone must have it. Well, the one I just read, the 2nd of October from the legal advisor, Ngema, I said, meaning and implication. That is the one we're referring to. The parliamentary legal advisor. We want you to have it so that you can be on board. Now, what I'd like you to do, Ms. Ngema, I'd like you to talk us through the key issues here. There's no need to go word for word, but to highlight the thrust of this. Unless it is absolutely pertinent you read each word, but we do have it. Thank you. Everyone got it.
Thank you, Chairperson. My note before the committee was basically on the point that we had already discussed on the previous meeting, and we were sticking to the term lawful investment as used in that top 5. Basically, I restricted what I had already said in the committee meeting and put it down in writing, to say that the use of lawful in clause 5 as it reads, this act applies to all lawful investments in the Republic which are made in accordance with the requirements set out in section 2. That basically if one looks at the term and the definitions that have been given of the term, there could be more that is given to it than what is intended. So in that regard, we look at the dictionary meaning of the term, and we also look at what other authorities which have defined the legal ways and phrases like the chosen. I also look at a few cases, like the case in Wood versus Executor's Estate, as well as the Minister versus Duplessis, which also tried to define lawful in context, as then it was used for those purposes. And basically what we concluded is that the word lawful is utilized in clause 2. It makes reference to a lawful enterprise in connection with the definition of enterprise that is already defined in this bill. and therefore if we use the term lawful in that role, it can be encompassing of many other instruments, for instance, your international law instruments, your common law and ordinances, and that basically was, in our view, considering that we have defined the restrictions and the parameters that we want for purposes of this bill, it would be safe to just say investment as tethered, which are meeting the requirements of Clause 2, and that would be sufficiently enough to cover all the concerns and queries that may arise or any ambiguity that can be read into the word lawful in this context. And therefore, we're suggesting that perhaps it would be safe to remove lawful and just have investments as indicated, which are subjected to Clause 2. Thank you, Chair.
Well, thank you, Ms. Gamer. I'm looking at the DGI advocate, Stryden.
He offered another apology that I haven't considered the other chair. But I've written to that chair. I'll have to seek guidance from my team, my principals earlier. But generally speaking, we're paying it off centrally with all due respect.
Yeah.
And I think we need to look properly and then maybe go to the committee on.
We're going to come back last to a state law advisor, all right? I think we'll come back last to you. Let's get Mr. DeGonna.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I think the phrasing has a very long history, and much of it relates to considerations of legality. In the definition of investment, we refer to a lawful enterprise. And so, when it comes to essentially selecting the wording here, we call merely for emphasis that it is not any investment, but a lawful investment. So an investment procured by fraud or any other means will not have the protection of law. So whereas we do not disagree with the opinion given by the parliamentary advisor, it is merely for emphasis and it is in correlation to the specific definition that we've given in Article 2. So, Madam Chair, given the context and given the importance of the reference to legality and lawfulness, we believe that it does not do any harm to leave that phrasing in the bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Now, we've heard from a legal as well practitioner in the area, can I put it that way? In fact, I said I would come last to your state advisor. Does the DDG wish to comment before I move to the state law advisor? Mr. Small, Advocate Small, is it Small or Small?
Small.
My,
you're not in rugby. No, I don't play. Okay, Chair. Either way, it could be regarded as correct. In our legal drafting principles, we would not actually put lawful in a sense that I didn't draft this for, so I apologize for that. But it's about certain words of that just causes ambiguity. It can emphasize that because you won't enter into unlawful, and it's a mere principle of that chair. So,
yeah.
I'll go with yes.
You'd go with it. The one comment, as I hear you saying, could be for emphasis. If we're looking at accessibility, we may want to keep it, whatever comes to the committee. Honourable Mkongi?
No, before I can say yes or no, where the lawful must fall. I just want to understand whether that emphasis is necessary or that emphasis is a matter of principle. Why that emphasis? So if it's not a matter of principle, why do we emphasize it?
I think the point that was made, one of the points, was that we have already used it throughout the bill, lawful enterprise, and we can just extract the whole thing. But so we need to just be a wee bit cautious here. We've used it in other areas where we didn't have a problem with lawful enterprise. I would ask all members to think very carefully on this one, because what the state law advisor is saying, it is neither, it's not a matter of right or wrong. Okay? It's a matter of choice of the committee members. Do they want to leave it there to emphasize that we need, this is the way we want things done? And what is interesting is that we have in the past had one or two little cases where something has been legal elsewhere in another country that when coming here is not actually according to our law. And it may be a moot point, but for those who are advocates, it may be very clear, now hang on, it may have been okay there, is it okay here? So that would be my interpretation of the emphasis here. But that is a personal, I want you to feel free to put your own comments in. Right, can I look at the members quite clearly? Those are the facts as well. You know, Honourable Elvis, you're a legal man yourself. Do you have any comments?
Actually, my comments relate to something else I would like to talk about. But, I mean, I think it's, you know, it would be a little bit superfluous to put lawful in, but I don't think it really matters if it's in either way, because the investments need to be in accordance with the law, and I think we've stated that, you know, in further in or earlier in the bill, is also statements that reflect or relate to lawful investments, investments that must be in accordance with the Constitution.
Coming to the notes we have, it was yourself, Honourable Hill, who asked for that inclusion. What is your view now that you've heard everything?
No, Chair, I think I merely suggested this inclusion because the previous wording was clumsy. So this was just a suggestion to clean it up, and if you want to take out the block, I've got no problem with it. As long as the rest of the sentence is well, we set that.
Well, let's not waste time on, you know, smaller issues here. Let's look at the ANC. What is your position finally? The ANC's position. We have the GA. Happy to withdraw it. Yes, ANC?
Thanks, Chair. Yes, we're of the opinion that you can we can remove the lawful. Thank you.
Right. I'm now looking at Ms. Ngema. Look, I think the committee is of that opinion. It was added in as a suggestion by the Honourable Hilders, but let's take it out then. So we now go back to reading. This Act applies to invest in the Republic, yeah. Okay. So we just take out the word lawful. Is that right? Move, we move, principle is going back. Yeah, Honourable Elvis?
I just would like to get an understanding of the process being followed, and I might have missed before. There's certain transitions that we made in the previous meeting to get where the detail was here, and I don't see those submissions made by myself in here at all. And that has been rejected or accepted or anything like that. So are we going to revisit that later in the committee and just deal with the DGI submission, or can I actually talk about that now? Thank you.
No, it needs to come now as we move in. This is what I try to point out.
No.
You know, as we're going through this, whatever you have come up with here that falls into what we said, that's why we say to you, do you have a problem? Do you want to add? You come in. I'm looking at the DA's one right at the moment. We're not there yet. That's clause 7, all right? I'm looking at something else. It's not there yet. The legal, we've discussed that now. Then we look at yours there, Honourable Elvis, clause 5 in particular. Do you want to speak to it? Look, we are looking at this, members. It's, the additional comments from members in writing. If we turn to the back page, there's one from the Freedom Front. The Act applies to lawful. Will you take us through that, Honourable Albert?
Yes, ma'am. I will do now. Just to see what on this paper. Yes, right. With regards to clause 5. Right, so what I've added, at the end of the sentence, it continues then to say, and confirms the South African government's obligations with regard to the protection of Republic's investors outside the Republic. Now, it comes back to the matter of reciprocity, where, you know, BIG cancelled, then overseas investors receive protection within South Africa.
giving.
But the African invaders who invade overseas do not necessarily have any protection there. And there's no certainty that government will actually try and act on its behalf wherever they might be involved. So I want to address that in this bill as well. Otherwise, we can create a legal vacuum when it comes to our own investors overseas, while we actually give protection to investors in South Africa. We ironically don't give really protection to our investors who take the risk to invest in any other country overseas. Thank you very much.
I was looking at that here. Currently, I think one of the issues at the outset we may wish to not even argue about, we could the issue of Section 2 of the Act. You know what I mean? It's being specific, which act are we talking about? Is this Act? So let us not look at the frame of the Act, but what comes after that. And confirm, and are you happy with us taking unlawful out, unlawful elders, you know, the earlier lawful which we discussed?
Yes, I think lawful would be covered by other sources.
All right. So
it's implied that it must be a lawful investment that may be in South Africa.
All right.
Yeah.
So we've taken lawful just out of this proposal, and we asked, and I want committee members to comment on that and confirm the SA government, etc. Honourable and Congi.
No, I want us to be consistent. Meeting that we've discussed this matter, this proposal is rejected outright. We said it, you know what, to deal with the protection of investment in the borders of the Republic of South Africa. And the DG went at length to explain how are we protecting investment overseas or in other countries, which is part and parcel of the programs of the department. So this was rejected. And then I don't know why now we are putting it. I know we spent something like 15 minutes debating this matter. So I don't think it needs to be included. We can just end at this act and then full stop.
All right, I'm looking at the notes taken during this meeting because, as you know, I wasn't chairing that meeting. And I'm looking at the notes made by the content specialist. So just give me a minute.
What type of question is it? I'm the only viewer at this. Five. Yeah, I set my computer on. What is five again?
It applies to all investments in the Republic which are made in accordance with the requirements set out in Section 2.
Okay.
And so there's excluding the
master. I understand, as it is for, yes, legal advisor. So that was one of the reasons we approached you on the matter,
yeah.
Your team actually, consisting of advocates Glenn, you, and Johan, and yourself.
Right.
Now, we got a five-page comment here, so what I'm going to ask you to do, advocate for, is to, you've heard what the Honourable Albert has said, alright? He put that in, he was quite legitimately out of the country on committee work, so perhaps you can highlight the pertinent areas in this written response. Have you got it? I know that it may be a little bit small, the
similar.
Yes, that is the DOJ one and the CD one. You'll see their names at the end. While we are just awaiting the legal advice here, can we get to hear from you, Advocate Schneider?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will not go into the opinion specifically. I saw the opinion this morning. I had the opportunity to read it briefly. The essence of the opinion, I'm not speaking from my colleagues now here, as to the effect that what is being proposed here implies necessarily extraterritorial application of the laws. Madam Chair, with respect, from my little technical perspective, I'm not here to speak on consideration of policy, which this is to a large extent, but purely based on legal principle. that is something that is problematic right from the outset. The moment we start talking about extraterritorial application of laws or extraterritorial protection of investors in other countries, having their own domestic laws, having their own sovereignty in respect of law making, the concept is problematic. But I see the Honourable Albert is keen to respond. But allow me just to say something specific in respect of what he is proposing, if you may, Chair. What is being proposed here, and can we read it closely, the exact wording, and confirms the South African government's obligations with regard to the rest. So, with respect, this proposal presupposes or necessarily implies that the South African government has these obligations. Because it's asking for those obligations to be confirmed, not to be established. Confirm the South African government's obligations. I'm going to leave it at that for the time being. I can see that the Honourable Albert is very keen to speak.
Are you suggesting that you have no problem with and confirm?
No, that's not what I'm saying.
Because it doesn't sound like that at all.
That's not what I'm saying at all. And that is a matter of policy upon which I should not be pronounced.
Right.
My principles are here to speak on that. All that I'm saying, purely on the basis of the reading, it says that those existing obligations of the government in respect of extraterritorial protection of investors must be confirmed. So it presupposes that there must be obligations in place. That is all that I'm suggesting, Madam Chair.
No, thank you. I am coming back to you, Honourable Albert. I just want to hear from Advocate Morton. Are you ready, Advocate Morton?
Yes, Chair. Unfortunately, I can't memorize my whole document. I've already. Yes, ma'am. Chair, I refer in the document to the Kawunda case which was heard in the Constitutional Court, and it sets out clear principles on the jurisdiction.
Just one moment, that is page 3 of this opinion of Advocate Small, etc. At the bottom of page 3, number 4. Right.
Yes, Chair, and it would have been other cases also, Mohammed and others, but in this one specifically, and the Constitution Court held that our legislation can only hold our borders, Chair, and so there are other measures in place, and we cannot beyond that. So that's the crux of it, Chair, and I think we did.
It may have been that the Honourable Albert also never had this opinion at the time, but let me allow him to speak. Honourable Albert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to state that in the previous meeting it was never outright rejected, this proposal. I give you our share, but I'll take it back and come back with an opinion that we've made today, and thank you for that. Now, that opinion or answer is a straw man. It's shooting down something that I never ever said proposed, and that's why I want to stop.
Okay.
The legal advisors from talking, because they're talking about something that's not on the table. I'm not talking about extraterritorial jurisdiction. I'm talking about South African government's obligations within the Republic of South Africa to protect their investors overseas. What does that mean in practice? It means South African government, and this must be clarified, must intervene diplomatically, first. Secondly, then by using other forms of international law to protect South African investors overseas. I want that clarified. That is a South African obligation within the Republic of South Africa. It's not extraterritorial jurisdiction that I'm implying here. That's law 101, extraterritorial jurisdiction in our civil international law. I mean, I don't even know why this opinion was given.
Oh,
you are not answering my question. And it's like you don't want to answer my question. I'm putting it to you. Straightforward. Why would you not want to protect our investors overseas? The international law as it is does not protect our investors. So you leave a lacuna in law that will leave our people out in the lurch when they take the risk to invest in another country. Why are you doing that? And why are you ignoring my pleas and giving me answers that mean nothing? Because it's not what I said in the first place. Thank you.
Yeah. allow me just to indicate, I had said to most of you at the time that I was consulting our specialists' notes. Now what she has indicated here in terms of the meeting is that no principal disagreement, but the legality of including this possibly should be reflected in the preamble. That is the content specialist's notes. Now, they are generally quite succinct and to the point. However, given that I was not at the meeting when this came up, which, if I was, I haven't got those notes with me. Let me simply leave this for the moment, because that is not the recollection of the content specialist. I'm not aware that we have the minutes, do we? No. So if we get the minutes, I think that's the time to take issues. So what I'd like, honourable members, is for us to be substantive on this issue. Because it's very difficult for me to come in at a point where people have a different understanding of what happened at the meeting. I would like to get the minutes of that meeting, and if this becomes a more serious matter, I will get the hands off. But I want that very clear. I don't want to discuss that now. I want us to look at the substantive issue, which is on the table, and to which both the state legal advisors apply their minds on this, honourable elders, could say, and nothing else, and which I understand the department, but I am looking at the DDG, applied your minds. Am I correct? So having got that, I would like to hear from Mr. Dagama. Mr. Dagama, I'm not sure if you were at that meeting. If you would address the substantive issue that is proposed here.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I think at the meeting, Honourable Albert proposed the written submission that we had before us verbally. We did take this into account, and I think as the state law advisors rightly point out, this law does not have extra jurisdictional effect. However, the Honourable Member indicates that that is not his concern. His concern is that the Republic has an obligation to protect its citizens, and more specifically, when a citizen makes an investment abroad, that the Republic has an obligation to intervene in some way or another. As I understand it, this is the intervention that the Honourable Member is making. Taking that particular perspective, I think very shortly we can deal with it in a few ways. The first one is that yes, any citizen has the right to petition government, and international law says that governments may intervene in different ways. One of the ways that Honourable Albert suggested at the last meeting was, for instance, diplomatic protection. Now, of course, if one looks at this particular principle and how our courts have pronounced on this particular principle, it's quite clear that, yes, a citizen may have the right to request government, but government may deny this request based on due process requirements. So even if we say nothing about the additional proposal that the Honourable Member has put on the table, these processes are part and parcel of the constitutional democracy that we have in South Africa. And so ultimately, Madam Chair, we believe that the general ambit of law provides the necessary guidelines for citizens to exercise their democratic rights, to petition government to act in a particular manner. And if the due process is not followed, there are various procedural rights that citizens gain in addressing any decision that government may make. So from that perspective, if we understand that the point being made here is that yes, citizens will have this right. Whether the bill states it or not, it is part and parcel of the fabric of South African law. So, Madam Chair, in finally addressing the proposal, we believe it's superfluous in the sense that it is already covered by general South African law, and as a result, the objectives of this Act is not to protect investments abroad, but to be in line with South African law in general. That is to say, not to create any obstacles for those rights to exercise. We believe that the formulation of the Act perfectly takes this into account. We believe that the issue has been addressed and may be considered to be moved. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. De Gama. I think that's put it in perspective, all right? Now let's take it from there, all right? So I want to take Honourable Williams last here. I'll take one DA first. Yes, Honourable Phil Lewis.
Thank you. Chair, the way that I understand it in my mind as someone who doesn't have formal legal training is that in the same way that the law obliges our government to help South African citizens who are in trouble abroad,
yes.
If someone gets into trouble while they're overseas and they are a South African citizen and hold their South African passport, then they can rely on the fact that our consulates, wherever they are, will help them. Mm-hmm. And our law here makes that possible. And so the way that I understand this, and someone must correct me if I'm wrong, is that all we want to say is that when there's a South African company, just like when there's a South African person, when there's a South African company who is in trouble abroad, that our government will come to their assistance. And I don't think that that's an unreasonable request. That actually makes a lot of sense to me. And part of the problem with cancelling the bits is the bits were bilateral. That's what the name said. They were two-way. And so we got some protection out of them as well. But this bill, because it's not a bit, it's a piece of legislation, doesn't give us that bilateral protection. And so to me, this just sounds like an effort to try and introduce some of that bilateral protection, and I think that that's unreasonable to me.
Right. Thank you, Honourable Hill Lewis. And I please have, I will give you the last response on the elder. I would like to hear from all parties on this before I come to Honourable Elvis, Honourable Esther Hazen, and then I'm taking the ANC.
Madam Chair, thank you. Also, on the lack of legal training, I would like to say that this bill has actually replaced the bilateral investment treaties, which covered investors in this country and also foreign investments from South African overseas. And at a time, it reassured that in the undertaking that all investment will be treated not less favorably in South African like circumstances here and if I may be abroad. My only concern, Madam Chair, is maybe that the bill itself is not a cause for concern. I think I mentioned it last time. It's together with a host of other laws or planned laws that maybe a disparity in metrics is being sent to foreign investors. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable
Esther
Hazen, Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, bearing in mind what Advocate Strain said just now, and also the purpose of the bill, the African National Congress rejects the proposal by the Freedom Front Plus. Thank you.
Ellis.
Madam Chair, if we look at our past, let's just go have a look at Zimbabwe and our South African investors in Zimbabwe. What has the Commonwealth asked for them? I want to ask the legal advisors who's just giving me all these clever answers. What does it mean for them? Absolutely nothing. Why? Because the government of South Africa has an option whether to entertain their petitions or not for intervention. And they decided not to do much about it. That is a fact. Right? So many people lost millions and millions, I'm not talking about individuals, even companies lost millions of rand in Zimbabwe. And I'm putting it to this government that they have an obligation that we must write into law that they must act with the utmost and highest degree of responsibility towards its own citizens investing overseas countries. Why would you want to protect in law, clarified precisely, in this parliament, investors coming from overseas, but not our own people? What is wrong with that principle? I have to ask you. We can codify the obligations of the government into this bill, or any other bill for that matter. I don't really mind if it's not in this bill. But the principle must come up of reciprocity. I don't see that. This government must be obliged to intervene in various ways, because even international law, it says that when you want to look at internal remedies before you can look at international remedies, if your local law is such a nature that it actually prejudices against you, you don't have to actually try to look at local remedies first. So let's say we future have a government that is very, very belligerent for whatever reason towards its own citizens, then a piece of law will force them to act on behalf of their citizens. We cannot leave it to the discretion of a government to do that in terms of law. Thank you.
Right, I think the point has been well made. What we're going to do, members, and this is important, this issue will be flagged. We have to have another colour. We've already got red and green. Blue. Another blue for this, and it'll go in for a flag for a final decision, not on Tuesday or Wednesday. But yes, it will come back for consideration on Wednesday. Wednesday. Alright? It will enable me, or whoever's chairing, I hope you're listening, to actually reflect on this and to get further advice. There are a number of issues for the PG.
Depends on what I think I have sympathy with Honourable Albert, as you indicated about the intention and the requirement that governments assist investors, whether they're inside the country or outside the country and so on. But I think what he mentioned there was, and I quote him to say, you must write into law. That is what is required of us. But as you know, we have a separation of powers in the executive, the legislative, and the judiciary. So we're the executive. We've got a legal opinion. And as you say, it is law 101. But it is not possible to have such a law. The constitutional judges have clearly said the constitution and the requirements on this country, this government cannot apply extraterritorially. There can be no obligation of Africa which will apply in Germany or in Zimbabwe. It is not possible to have such a law. But if you believe this legislature has those powers, then I think obviously the honourable member must table such a law.
I think, look, we got the DG's position of the executive. Am I correct? It's clear. Right. Now, Honourable Elvis, we are clear, this is a separation of powers. This is the legislature. And that is why I am actually asking for some time myself to study all the legal opinion, so that when we take a final position, everyone, including myself and the Honourable Kalako, who is not well today, is fully on the breast of it. And that's why I am saying I'm going to close the discussion and the input. I want to discuss this with legal advisors myself outside of this meeting. And that's why I asked for the program. The program we will meet, our meeting on Tuesday the 27th. And we're meeting on the 28th. Now, I think it's important for us to give ourselves a bit of space. Nothing much other than saving someone's life crossing a road was achieved shooting from the hip. So I do want to inform myself. I don't want to give the wrong advice in this case. So I'm going to flag. It's not closed on all elders, all right, thank you. And now what we're going to do, members, is, I just want to check where we are with this. There were some other inputs from that one from the Honourable Albert. I'm looking at the DA, there's nothing on clause 5, you know, per se. Just looking at yourself and the ANC, right. And as we move from there, which is the application of the Act, we then also, we have got a few other things here. Added to this, under this section, is something from the department, my correct, EDG and Advocate Stream, called Fair and Administrative Strength. But, now I understand that this must have come up and that you want to make a proposal here. Now, are you able to speak just to the proposal DDG so that a position can be taken? Do you see that? Number 6. Page 8. Right.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. This tries to deal with the proposal of the DA with regards to the standards of treatment. What we have done is to develop a new paragraph 6 that clarifies administrative justice that will be provided to investors in line with the South African Constitution. We have borrowed and then shared what was in clause 3. Already we had made provision for the fact that the rights of investors are protected in section 32, 33 and 34 of the Constitution. So the new proposal read as follows. The government shall ensure administrative, legislative and judicial processes do not operate in a manner that is arbitrary or that denies administrative and procedural justice to investors or their investment as provided for in the Constitution and applicable legislation. That is a big one. 6.2 talks to the review of administrative decisions as provided for in Section 33 of the Constitution. The subsection 3 talks to the fact that the investors have access to information in terms of Section 32 of the Constitution as well as applicable legislation. Then in terms of its use, that is covered for in line with Section 34 of the Constitution. So that is the proposal. It aims, as I've said, Madam Chair, to try and address the concern that was raised by the VA in terms of the standard of treatment that is provided. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, DDG. Let's look to the committee members. Any comment, Honourable Hilda?
Yes, Chair, I appreciate that the department has taken the proposal that I made seriously, and I like the wording that they've come up with. So I'm happy to accept it, and I would only make one very small amendment in paragraph 2 where there seems to be a typo. That's the only suggestion I've made.
That is the DA, and this was something that they raised in particular. Is there any other comment here, the ANC?
Did
one of you take it on
the
Colonel?
Yeah, we agree, Chairperson.
Right. Okay. Fine. Can I just a minute, while this committee is just thinning itself out of existence, we are going to have tea break shortly.
I'm sorry to interrupt, Madam Chair, but maybe we have the title from the Honourable Lewis, please. In subsection 2, I think you refer.
It says, Chair, shall include the right to be given written reasons and administrative review of decision. So, can you see that doesn't read, there's something wrong there. It should be, include the right to be given written reasons and the administrative review of decisions. Decisions, consistency. Yeah.
Decision.
The administrative decision of the administrative review of decisions, plural.
Otherwise, we're on track. Honourable Colonel, right? Honourable Albert, at the back, right? Decision, right? Just a little glimpses down there of the back row there. Yes. And thank you very much, DDG, and your crafters and the Advocate Stratum for that, because it takes us to page 9. Now, what we're going to do is just check if there is tea. Perhaps I could ask our researcher, I know it's not your job, and what with all these job descriptions now, the right of, I think I'll do my own job description as well, right of establishment, number 6. Now, just as a matter of interest, Advocate Freedom, or any of the parliamentary legal people or state, application of the Act 1.5, we've got this new additional 6.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, it'll fall into line the new 6. So, okay, it's currently 6. Currently. Mm-hmm. But it, consequentially, it will change.
Madam Chair, the only reason why we haven't done the renumbering, and of course the question of the cross-referencing, is if we wait for the Honourable Committee to adopt, and once adopted, the renumbering and cross-referencing will take place.
I want to thank you very much, Honourable Advocate Stratum. I'd like just to finish on the right of establishment. On this point, Lily.
Yes, Madam Chair, we raised this point when we're talking about the headings. So this should be establishment. We need to take out the right of.
Now, members, you do remember this on the sections, etc. Are we in agreement? Are we in agreement? I said, Hansard does not recall nothing.
Yes.
There's just something I will raise as a flag. Okay. We have a flag here from the content specialist indicating that some member of the committee, I don't know who, raised the issue of a post-establishment clause. Do you recall that? Is that going to be dealt with later? I'm looking at the DDG. Can we just leave it as a flag, and will you come back on that? Or can you do so now?
We can clarify, Madam Chair. The issue was with regards to subsection 2. If you recall, Madam Chair, we moved or swapped them around because there was a concern that it's more negative. So we started with the more positive language to emphasize that all investments must be established in compliance with the laws of the Republic. So 2, which is what is emphasizing the post-establishment rights, this Act does not create a right for a foreign investor or prospective foreign investor to establish an investment in the Republic. Members can reflect whether that language is fine or we need to review that language. If necessary, we can review, but we're submitting it to the aid is now, so that we start with the more positive language, but still emphasizing the concern around the post-establishment. And I must emphasize, Madam Chair, that it's important that we emphasize the post-establishment rights, in that in other jurisdictions, investors have an automatic right, and we have to emphasize that in the case of South Africa, investment must be established in terms of South African law and must comply with domestic laws of the country. So that point is important to be emphasized. But of course, we'll leave it to a committee to reflect whether that takes care of the concerns that were raised. Thanks, Madam Chair.
I think just a quick comment on those, because I don't know who did this, so keep on for Hildur.
I just want to check that it doesn't apply any kind of pre-vetting or panel process. Okay.
And
DDG
has indicated no.
No, it doesn't.
Members, can you see where we are? We're going to break the key. Yesterday, I informed the committee that unfortunately I'll be going into hospital. And I am now leaving to go and follow doctor's orders rather than the orders of the committee. And we had hoped, the whip and myself, that he would be here but he, as you know, had a medical problem, but he will be here in Parliament on Tuesday. Given that this is the case, I need to step out of the chair, and I need to ask you and ask the Secretary of the Committee, Mr. Hermans, to elect an acting chair. So after tea, when you come back, you will proceed. But I do want to say, before I leave the chair, we have a SAG and issue. Is that quite clear? Because the chair needs to inform herself, and I need to inform the whip as well. So please don't go back on that till Tuesday, as I have taken a decision on that already. So I'm now going to step out of the chair, and Mr. Hermans will proceed right now.
Well, this in terms of from the assembly rule 131, we'd like to proceed with the electing of an acting chair in absence of the chairperson until she returns to the committee. Can we have a proposal for such a...
Chair, I'm proposing Honourable Lillard's media.
Is there a seconder for that?
I second the proposal. Thank you.
Are there any other being... Having no other nominations, I will ask Mr. Williams to take the chair after the break.
Yes, Mr. Secretary, can we just wish the former chairperson a very speedy recovery and a speedy return to us?
She wants to keep it.
She wants to keep it.
She wants to keep it. Motion, I don't know what difference this Dr. Ocean will do to the rest of the course. It's a great problem, yeah? Yeah.
On that fish?
Yeah, because in you have to read the conversation.
Tawanda and Muhammad,
Muhammad.
It's kind of wrong. Yeah, we are talking diplomatic politics.
Yeah.
And diplomatic politics are taken.
And just because it's clear.
They are very clear. Those two
clear.
Do you think what I'm thinking? About the diplomat protection that...
Yes, I read that as well, yes.
...referred to.
Yes.
Because that's actually what the answer is the later is discussing now. It's about the diplomatic protection of it of African
There's three interests. They might be killed, or they might be this, or they might not. We can't end things, and we must allow
the
to unfold. You know what I mean? And international things kick in. You know what I mean? And
what
the thing
you can say is that a diplomatic protection must need an opposition at the end of the day. And even from international law, it's not a problem. In Syria,
I think it's a misery for you to say, but you have to talk to me now. At some point, then it comes up again.
But it came up again when it was initially, when it was an issue of
ethics.
Because now there's a confusion.
Then don't talk about it. Focus on the diplomatic
and how these actually
are and why.
And I think it's quite important to say you're speaking on it, but it's not important. And the opinion from the people are better to look at that.
Yes, and not the diplomatic.
But it's straightforward, and Dagama explained it, but also it was indirect.
So it's in the issue of what synthesis applies to.
And he made it clear that it's a petition. He requested them. And when they make up their mind, that was all the fact.
But I think it's now a constituency issue. It is a constituency.
Say, and I need to know if they fight.
But if we can look at it, you guys can look at it.
Because we didn't get back there, but I said, cross over. And like that, we should need to come back.
No, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I said, you came back to Monday, I said, no, you're supposed to say
this. No, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I
have this
opinion now.
So we are saying this
to everybody. Oh, she's
And see, we have all the factors. Do we have the resources to help you? Do we bring the message that we must actually, instead of serving mass people, that we must make a decision and inform the people that it can come as an obligation that is regulated? From the international standpoint, yes, I have credit to this, 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 this. Technology is there, but it's a discussion on it. Monday, FHM meeting.
But have to consider what I'm talking
about. Have to consider everything. And it cannot be imposed by designating legislation.
Yes,
but are there other people who think that the international people that speak to it anyway?
I think
I think it would be put to question so that we are here.
Yeah.
On the name.
Yes, so I want to ask a few questions from you so that you give it to the answer and then respond to that question.
That's
a specific question. And then it's a decision the committee will take. I think it's an informed decision. Because
you
can't
do something.
Yeah.
That doesn't help.
Yeah, no, that would help. I can protect you then from.
Mm-hmm.
Because you wake up, it's something completely different.
That's the thing. It's in the year 21.
So, I've been doing 21 and I told myself, and you're not going to come.
I'm doing it also.
Thank you. Can we reconvene, please? Okay, we're going to start now. Okay, we're going to move now to the clause titled National Treatment. I see there that the green 7.1 says foreign investors. Are we all agreed with that? Mm. So can you please say so?
Agree.
Thank you. Then on the next page, at the bottom it says paragraph G is omitted, and that's in red. So I take it there was some debate around that. Okay, so we'll take that as agreed. So paragraph G, that would be 4G submitted, and then go to point 8 at the bottom of the page, which is physical security of property, and then we have to refer back to the name of that because there's a name change there. So are we agreed on that change to physical security of property? From in its former name of security investment.
We didn't agree with that. We changed it to physical security of investment.
Mm. Okay. So does anybody else want to comment on that?
Agreed.
Okay, so it's now going to be physical security of investment.
Yeah.
Okay, and then on that clause, the clause is entirely in green. Ms. Peter.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Just a minor one, it's just a matter of style. Instead of saying in line in the second sentence, you're proposing in accordance. Eight, the Republic must accord foreign investors and their investment the level of fiscal security as may be generally provided to domestic investors in accordance. Thanks, John.
Is there agreement on that? Good job. Please hear the agreement. Thank you. Okay, the next section is the legal protection of investment. Are we happy with that? The title. Um,
I just want to raise, the proposal by the DA was clause 8 there. Are we covered by the proposal, the what the department came up with, to try and deal with that?
No, Chair, the clause 8 was dealt with in the previous proposal, but there was a clause 10 as well that, or new clause 9, basically, that I proposed, which is not dealt with here. Mr.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. We have considered the proposal that has been made by the DA, and I think previous discussion on the point highlighted very much the fact that this particular bill was to be in accordance with other processes that deal with the protection of property, and specifically the expropriation bill. And so ultimately, it was felt that the reference that we have in a bill currently is sufficient to address the interventions that have been made by the DA specifically. So from that perspective, Mr. Chair, we believe that what is contained in the current bill is sufficient to reflect all of the points that have been made by the proposals submitted by the DA.
Chair, thanks. But I'm afraid that was a bit of an answer. The current clause is simply not sufficient because it just makes general reference to the Section 25 of the Constitution, and it doesn't unpack what specifically that means in terms of how the Republic plans to protect investments. And that is one of the core concerns for investors, is that the protections in Section 25 are not given substantive effect in the legislation itself. And so my proposal addresses two concerns which the investors raised and many of the people in our public hearings raised as well.
You carry on.
The first chair was that the Constitution distinguishes between, the Constitutional Court has distinguished very clearly between that which is expropriation and that which is deprivation. And the judgments of the Constitutional Court made it very clear that their ruling was not precedent-setting. It was specific to that case. And the feeling of the judges of the court were that each case, in the absence of legislation which dealt and fleshed out that distinction, each case would have to be dealt with on its merits by the court. And so what this attempts to do is to reassure investors that not only do they have the right not to have their property expropriated as is clear in the Constitution, but also that they have the right not to be arbitrarily and unreasonably deprived of their investments. And I think that clears up and provides some kind of legal legislative support rather to what the Constitutional Court judges identified in their judgment. Keep in mind, Chairperson, that the intention of this is what we want is a bill that reassures investors and provides absolute concrete peace of mind to them that their investments here are secure. And they currently do not have that peace of mind and have said so publicly. And so I think if there's no legal impediment to us including this language, then I would feel more comfortable, and I think they would feel a great deal more comfortable to have in. And it doesn't sound like, from what Mr. Gama said, that there's any legal impediment. It's just, in their view, it's not necessary. I'm saying that, in a point that Mr. Gama made before our recess, this bill must also have a demonstration effect. It needs to demonstrate visually to investors that we mean what we say. And so I think the insertion of this clause will go a long way to doing that.
Do other members want to say something?
I still remember when we were discussing this matter. For example, we said, when it reads that investors have the right to properly hear those questions that apply of the Constitution, we went in detail to Section 25 of the Constitution and it's explaining what is protection of property in detail. And we said there is no need for us to expand this particular sentence. The second thing that I want to raise to Honorable Mayimbuzi, why this should have a substantive effect? Because the whole bill speaks about the Bill of Rights, and I went to the Bill of Rights. So, this protection is within even the single sentence, first sentence of this particular bill speaks about this protection of this right. So why must we do tautology? Because we're explaining all the pages of this bill of this protection. So I don't understand, because the Bill of Rights explains this, Section 25 explains this, so I don't know why.
Honourable person. Thanks. The Honourable probably asked, why should it be substantive? I ask the question, why should it not be substantive?
Okay.
And it should be, Jay, because if we want to write law, we want it to be clear and definitive all the way through, not referring to this and checking up on that and going back to this and that. We want it to be substantive and definitive in its entirety. And I think for, you know, for us to say, why should it be substantive, is, you know, it's a cop-out for actually for giving the definitive whole picture to investors that they are clear in what their rights and recourses are in terms of investment and security of investment. And I think that it's important that we try and be as definitive and expensive as possible when it comes to this particular issue.
Okay. Does any of the legal fraternity want to comment? No. Okay, I think that this is a similar to clause 5, and we'll come back to this clause.
I may quickly respond to my colleague, Mr. McConkie.
We're not going to have you responding to each other. We understand there's a debate around this particular clause and your recommendations. And I would say that the way forward is for us to park this for the moment, and then we have a full committee next week. We can engage on it again.
Fine. Thank you.
Okay. 10 and 11 have got no green or red. Moving to 12. Dispute resolution, 12.2A. Just hold on. So, could the DG talk to us on section 12.2A and B and C, etc. Thank you.
Go on.
Sorry.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As per the request from the honourable members, what we did with this particular clause is essentially to automatically establish certain criteria in the bill, as opposed to leaving it to the minister to regulate at a later stage. And so it would make more sense to have these criteria reflected in the bill. And essentially what we've done in sub 2A is to indicate that there should be some sort of list of qualified mediators with some sort of criteria which is suggested. And of course that the parties necessarily could agree specifically on who should be appointed, but that there be some sort of substantive discipline around the fact that there should be a list and also an initial indication of the characteristics of possible mediators. Subsection D just confirms that the parties can agree the appointment of a mediator. And then subsection C, and there's 2 points here. The one is that parties may jointly request the department or, and in the alternative, a competent authority to appoint a mediator from the list established, or in the absence of a list, individuals proposed by either party. So the one question here is, who shall be the appointing authority? In many instances, the department may be constituted as part of the state, and so one may want to think of an independent authority, such as the president of the law society, the judge resident of the high court, whatever that may be. Mr. Chair, in subsection D, we've developed some sort of rules in respect of the mediation process, which we propose should be attached to the bill. This was done in response to some of the interventions by the DG recalling the recent publication of the investment chapter between the European Union and the United States of America. So we've crafted some provisions that set out the process of mediation between the parties. This also is proposed to be a sub-annex to the Act itself. And then, Mr. Chair, subsection 3 just formalizes the information that has to be provided to the department, and I think that form has previously been circulated to this committee. Thank you.
Members, any comments on this, Members? Chair, I'm very much happier with the whole of Section 2. I think if we could just deal with Section 2 first and then go on to the rest, because there's still some concerns about the rest.
I think we also agree with Section 2, but I just have a question about Section C, where you spoke about the required department. Why do we have those?
Mr. Chair, I think as we explained, the responsibility of the department is essentially to maintain a list. However, in certain instances, the department necessarily forms part of the authority. So under certain circumstances, decisions have to be made. So parties can agree to the appointment of a mediator, but in instances where they do not agree, you may want to leave a decision to a third party as opposed to the department, unless the honourable members feel that this is something that the department can exercise in an objective and non-partisan way.
Thank you. With regard to that C, we as members need to choose whether or not we want it to say the parties may jointly request the department or a competent authority. Is that how it is? So we have to choose. So, members, please, which one would you prefer?
No, Kevin, here's what is, you know, the thing. The issue is that this foreign investors are coming to the country. And now, they make business in the country. And they are in conflict, not necessarily with the Department of Trade and Industry, but with state, on how they do business. So our understanding is to say that the department, as the Department of Trade and Industry, or responsible for trade and industry, can play as. So you must explain it very well. Because it's going to be confusing when we just say department. Because even myself was confused. Because if... Yes, I understand, but the issue is that if the company is in conflict with the Department of Trade and Industry, what happens? You see, so this must be clear.
Okay, so basically, like the Honourable Member said, what happens if the department is in the conflict? So wouldn't it be better to put or? The parties may jointly request the department or a competent authority. So we can put in or there. Melissa, what is your view on that? Do you agree? Do you disagree? Would you like more time on Facebook? I don't know what's happening up there.
You're right. The department is one of the parties, so it can't of itself.
It could be one of the parties, but it may not be. So that's why I said perhaps we should write to say the parties may jointly request the department or competent authority. So it covers it in the event that are we happy?
Are the lawyers happy? Are the lawyers happy? Maybe they're on Facebook too. I don't know.
Things, I mean, it's brought now. The court is asking us.
We can refine and
define. You need a caucus, okay. You can't just like the moments. Okay, just a moment, please, DG. Excuse me. my concern is this competent authority that may be appointed, who gets to choose that competent authority? Now, so this clause is a little bit, it doesn't explain it well enough. Shall we park this particular clause, or until you come up with a position?
My apologies, it was precisely that issue that I was saying we might have to just mention the authority, whether it's the arbitration society or the judge president or whatever. But I think we'll just come back on what to insert in the or, who the competent authority is here. Yeah. Right.
Or maybe add it under clause 1 of the cases.
Yeah. Competent authority means.
Also, you define the touches in the board, did you put it in the division? Because I also saw touches defined in the board, not in the division.
Yeah, it's just still covering the body.
So, what we'll do is we'll come back to that with a new rewrite. Okay, so are we down to three? We're moving to three now. Yes, if we could move to three, could okay, so Honourable Hill Lewis, would you want to raise something?
Just use the word territory. Sorry, 3-1-A. Mm-hmm. Usually the word territory there. Surely that's in the Republic. And then it may seem a minor point, but I don't think anyone still uses fax machines.
Yeah.
I haven't seen a fax machine in these 5 years. Yeah. So I think can we just remove facsimile number? I don't think anyone will know what that means.
Okay. There's no problem there. Just the territory one. We just replace that with Republic. Is that acceptable?
Yeah.
That is acceptable. Well, happy. I want to see happiness. Yes, thank you.
I don't know to be technical, but we need to consider. Do you see, in this part, we are, when we talk about foreign investor, F in capital letters for foreign, and then investor I in capital letters, is this what we've been doing through the week? You see, and if that is not the case, why do we have to do that?
These are consequential things, and we can check this. I'm assuming we can just check this. We will, okay? So now we're moving to 5, bearing in mind what we talked about in 3. Fundamentally, all of us challenges that we'll address at this next meeting. So in 5, this is... It was quite a controversial one previously. So I'd like some, sorry. Mr. Degan, talk to this this red section of number 5.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think various representations have spoken to the fact, but if a request to go to international arbitration would be made to government, government can merely refuse to do so. However, we've indicated that this right is not absolute, that any decision that is made constitutes some sort of decision, administrative action, which would then be subject to certain processes of review. And so if we read this insertion, the consideration of a request for international arbitration will be subject to the administrative processes set out in Section 6, which then makes clear that should a request be made, a mere no cannot suffice. There has to be compliance with the processes that are set out. So on a level of comfort, any investor requesting the government will have the assurance that government will act in accordance with its responsibilities, both set out in this particular bill, but also more specifically under the Constitution and general South African law, which may have further applicable legislation that makes more precise the content of these general obligations. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Members? Chair, with the red text suggested, I'm happy, but not with the rest of Section 5. That the dispute is only between the two home states. So I don't know whether we're only discussing the red text or whether we're discussing the whole clause.
No, we're discussing the whole clause. I just wanted, because the red text has just been added, so we're discussing the whole clause with the red text as well.
Right. Okay, so, Chief, yeah, I mean, I am still not satisfied that it is going to be adequate, to provide adequate peace of mind to the investment community that they cannot engage in investor state dispute settlement and that they have to lobby their home governments to take on the case on their behalf. Absolutely no guarantee that the government will oblige them for a range of reasons. Some of the reasons could be related to the story that the DG has told us because the case is completely frivolous, and some of the reasons could also relate to just, you know, global geopolitics and diplomatic relations between countries. I don't think it's good enough. The other argument that was made, which I want to rebut before we went on recess, is that this is a trend that's happening across the world. And there was a significant development during the recess in that members will have heard that the European Union and the US reached significant agreement on the draft text of the TTIP. And it was a surprise to me to learn that text does include ISDS. It doesn't move away from ISDS as was suggested. It doesn't move towards state-to-state dispute settlement. It maintains ISDS, but interestingly, it has some very nice innovations which I think could be useful for us. So, for example, it requires that the proceeding be conducted in the open and that all the documents from the investor be disclosed and filed publicly, and that the awards and the final judgments of the arbitration also be made public. It makes provisions for the expedited review of frivolous claims, for example. When claims are obviously frivolous, there's strong mechanisms for awarding costs against the frivolous claimants. As well as new rules to prevent parallel proceedings pursuing the same claim. Furthermore, there is a specific code of conduct and ethics guidelines for arbitrators and how those arbitrators should be appointed. There's a whole lot of new innovations in ISDS that go a long way to assuaging the concerns that the DG expressed with us that a republic would be subject to this endless list of frivolous cases that they would then have to engage in dispute settlements about. And I think those innovations would be very welcome in this bill,
and would greatly strengthen the bill and would greatly work to allay the concerns of the investor community.
Thank you. PG?
No, thanks for that. As I said, I think my colleagues can come in. But I think what was is very clear is that the investor state arbitration has been a major flaw. And as you see, that is why all those attempts are made to try to remedy those defects. But I think what I was saying is that generally there is a consensus that investor state is flawed and that there are a range of, that causes a range of jurisdictional problems and so on. So I think if you look at that, as I said, we are preferring the approach which the European are taking, which the OECD is taking. That I think those attempts are put on band-aid, just trying to, as you can see, 10 kinds of ways of trying to save this institution. I think this can't work. In as I said, people have different views, but our view is rather than taking on 10 points of band-aid or how to fix it, I think the best option is to do away with this question of frivolous, litigious ways, is to have the quality control of the state. And as Honorable Albers mentioned, all countries in the world, where there is a legitimate case of arbitrary action or expropriation, that state will support its investor. I don't think there's any government, any democratic government, that cannot, will not protect their home investor. I mean, that's why they have embassies. That's why they have DTI, they have trade representatives. That is why we have foreign offices, to protect our investors. So I don't think we're in this a legitimate case. So I think just we have the way forward, as I said, in our opinion, is to not try to put band-aid on this, as I said, dated institution. And we as I said, that's why we try to do. I think what was indicated is that we say that this decision to go for it is subject to rational decision making. If the minister refuses, as I said, as with anything else, he has to follow fair administrative justice. And if he, on unreasonable grounds, refuses a request for arbitration, in that instance, he can be challenged in the court of law. To say you're unreasonably, for example, he claims this case is frivolous and it's not. Then that will be set aside in terms of administrative justice. I think there is protection for, I think that concern that you won't get the support of your own government, I think is really extremely rare or very unlikely, given the bigger resolution of all, I mean, as we can see, you have chambers of commerce in every country, paid by government. You have a British Chamber of Commerce, American Chamber of Commerce. How, if there's any infringement of their rights, I don't think they'll ever use that.
Thank you, Chair. Just to probably complement the point that the DG is making on with respect to the private companies. If you look at the newest international agreement, multilateral agreement, which is the Marrakesh Agreement that establishes the WTO, it does not make provision for private companies to initiate actions where they feel that they have been injured. It makes provision for those companies to petition their governments so that the governments can then proceed with that dispute. So this is the agreement that establishes the WTO, and it is the newest multilateral agreement from 1994. So even internationally, there is a move away from these types of actions that enable, from these types of agreements that enable private investors to initiate actions without petitioning their governments in support of their governments. Thank you.
Before you, Conley, Honourable Elderson.
Thank you, Chairperson. No, I'm just concerned about the same thing as Honourable Ian Lewis, that, you know, a foreign investor might not have a willing government on his side that's taking his position. And then you also have the problem that if there's smaller investors who do not have a lot of money, let's say the foreign government is not willing to assist financially, let's say, well, we will give you consent to go
but you have to pay the cost fees. And the smaller indicators won't be able to pay the cost is subject entitled to the exhaustion of holistic remedies, and then go to court as well for non-compliance with administrative processes in South Africa. So I don't know how this will protect them, because I think with our minds we're always thinking about large investors, multinationals and the guys with deep pockets. But there are many individual investors in South Africa. For instance, that bought a property or might own a small business for whatever reason. And unless the rand drops further, it won't help them financially, to access our courts, or they won't have the financial resources to access our courts. So I do think that this needs a little bit more of an expansion, and I understand that you're saying that you want other governments to engage with you on when it comes to international arbitration, but those people, especially the small investors, will be left in the ditch if they governments actually don't want to support them, and you don't get any cooperation from this investing or investors government itself. So I think we must try and look at creating more space for these eventualities, so that we can capture everybody's concerns in the end. With our big investors, like Mercedes-Benz, VW, or smaller investors who might have invested in a small business in South Africa. Thank you.
Thank you. Any more comments?
I'm just encouraging team discipline. Because I think private sector should be accountable to their own nations. Why they don't want to be accountable? Because if your activities are not frivolous and so forth, the laws of the Republic are going to exonerate you. And if the things are also not frivolous, your nation, the whole country is going to catch you. But if they have diseases and you don't want to be accountable, you will want a very easy route and they undermine the state. So the spirit of this clause to me is also encouraging reciprocal responsibility between the nations and their citizens. And I don't think it infringes any rights. It's telling them that if you are not satisfied with our own laws and activities, therefore you can request your state to intervene on your behalf as a disciplined citizen. I think we're going to open these things, we're going to encourage people with ill discipline and unaccountable, to travel around into other institutions that are necessary and direction. So that's why I feel comfortable with this particular clause, because it encourages discipline.
Thank you.
Honourable Lewis.
Yes, Chair, I've just pulled up the marriage issue agreement. I haven't had a chance to read through it, but the bottom line is, that agreement is from 1994. I'm looking at the agreements that are being signed in the world right now. And both the TTIP and the DPP, which are massive, massive global trade agreements, contain investor-state dispute settlement. And I think that is something that we really need to take heed of, that, despite the objections of the EU, they have agreed to this. This is the text that they've agreed to. I am extremely concerned that this clause leaves so much to discretion. It leaves, first, it's the discretion of the home state as to whether they want to engage. And we can, it's just cold comfort to investors to say, well, usually your state will back you. There's no guarantee, but usually they will. There might be some delicate negotiations happening at the United Nations or at the WTO. There might be some other political considerations at work. And on this particular occasion, they say that those considerations outweigh your particular dispute, and so we must be able to take the matter up on your behalf. And then there's nothing that they can do. It's left entirely at the discretion of their own government. They have to lobby their government to get their support. And then even if the government agrees to take it up on their behalf, our government has the discretion about whether to enter into the arbitration or not. It says the government may consent to international arbitration. For me, it's just far too discretionary. I think that it is possible, using some of the innovations that are currently being discussed in global fora,
to address the concerns that the DG raises, and to use this as an opportunity to actually get South Africa to the cutting edge of global developments in IFES, and to lead the way. We can have stronger provisions on the rights of third parties to intervene in the proceedings. We can have stronger provisions on transparency and openness of the proceedings. We can really set ourselves up as the benchmark on ISDS instead of shying away from tackling these difficult questions simply because we have been subject to a few frivolous cases in the past. I don't think that's good enough reason.
Thank you. Now before you, Dagama, Mr. Dagama.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the TTIP does not move actually in the direction of international investment dispute settlement, because if you look at the text very closely, what the parties have agreed is to set up joint courts composed of judges from the United States and from the European Union. So de facto, it still amounts to a domestic resolution. There is no outsourcing of adjudication to an international body or to an international panel. It is essentially still domestic adjudication, where the judges are essentially appointed by the parties. They are sitting judges in the countries where they reside, and they form part of a list. So I think ultimately, the context is different, and it underscores the point and the concerns that have been raised by the DG. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. DG.
The point has been made. I just wanted to emphasize that point that what the EU proposal is, because it still has not been agreed in the TTIP, the EU proposal is to establish an investor court, which, as Mr. Kim has indicated, there will be five independent judges and from either side. But at the end of the day, it clarifies or also emphasizes the fact that there is no trust in the current system of inter-state disputes, because if we look at the cases and the UNCTAD presentation to the committee when we had the workshop, show that what is currently being challenged by investors is government's right to regulate in the public interest. So what we are trying to do with Clause 5 is to limit the risk to South Africa in terms of frivolous claims by investors challenging the government's right to regulate the public interest. And we've also, with a new addition, what we've done is to ensure that there will be accountability by the state to the investor if we are refusing any investor the right to state-to-state application. So the concerns that were raised before, we try to accommodate them by ensuring that in line with Section 6, we are emphasizing the right to administrative justice, where investors can then ensure that they are able to get reasons as to why government is not agreeing to a state-to-state dispute. So it won't be an arbitrary application of that clause. There will be accountability in terms of why we refuse, because we are saying in that clause, the investor will go through the domestic system, which is amongst the best in the world. The McKinsey report indicates that our judicial system ranks number 9 in the world in terms of efficiency. So there's no issue with regard to the independence of the judiciary and the accountability of the judiciary. So they will go through the judicial system. If there is a case after that that they want to take to state-to-state arbitration, then that right is open. And we are saying government may consent, because we have to look at the merits of the case and try to deal with frivolous claims, as you said. So that is the rationale, Mr. Chair.
Okay, before we go into a 6-hour debate on this, I think this is another one that we need to just park until we've got a full contingent of members here. Because we're just going to go round and round. You're going to say, you want more, honourable other members are going to say no. So let's get until we've got a full...
If I can just respond to the points made, Chairperson, and then I'm happy to rest for today. Firstly, I'd like to ask a factual question. I'm just reading it really quickly. Can you just point me to the section in the Marrakesh Agreement that said that...
Sorry, honourable member, please, we're not going
to
have a...
Chairperson, through you, can the department just point me to the section in the Marrakesh Agreement that says you can't have ISDS?
I can't find it, but I'm reading it very quickly. Secondly, you've just made a case that the point of relying on foreign governments to agree to these disputes is to prevent frivolous cases being brought. But now you're saying that even after they've agreed to that, which suggests that it is not a frivolous case, our government can still have the discretion to turn the matter down and not agree to arbitration because it could be a frivolous case. So that seems contradictory. Thank you. I just want to say the suggestion made about the independent courts sounds like an absolutely excellent idea. That would be a really creative way to maintain some elements of domestic procedure, but also satisfy the concerns and allay the concerns and fears of the investment community with regards to doing away with ISD. So my response would be, great, let's do that then. And we can build in a whole of things in those in those provisions for public interest. And right to regulate, but the principle is that the investor cannot simply rely on the discretion of its government and our government to protect his or her investment.
Okay, I'll start with Mr. Gama and then DG. Okay.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and without trying to intervene on behalf of the DG, the question was where in the Marrakesh Agreement is there a reference? Well, the Marrakesh Agreement refers to the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade of 1947, which was to be active for 2 years and would be replaced by the so-called GATT of 1994. If you go to the GATT of 1994, which is one of the anchors of the Marrakesh Agreement, you go to Article 22 and 23, you will see the procedures which are set out, and those relate only to members of the WTO. It is further clarified under the Dispute Settlement Understanding, which you will find under Annex 2 of the Marrakesh Agreement. So if one reads all of those together, one sees that it is intentionally a state-to-state mechanism which is called for in terms of dispute settlement.
I'm going to hear from DG, please. Thank you.
I was just coming back to the earlier point. And I think Honorable Yilwes has sort of indicated that people need to have access to independent tribunals. I think that, as we indicated, there's a separation of powers here. We have an independent tradition in this country. There's a separate executive. Can we take action as an executive? It is subject to review by an independent judiciary. Mm-hmm. So we're saying in this case, if an investor feels aggrieved by any actions of the executive, you will go to that independent judiciary, our courts of law. You can go right up to the Constitutional Court to challenge any arbitrary action. He doesn't need the support of his own government. He has all those rights. And as I said, we are in the top 10 of the world with regards to investor protection, and there's been no arbitrary action by this executive. So, people have access to an independent tribunal. The point about investor speculation and private arbitration tribunals or private arbitration is that it undermines those domestic judicial processes. That is what was the fundamental objection against them. That's why the court now is set up its own procedures so that it does away with this separate jurisdictional jurisprudence emerging from this unaccountable private arbitrators. So that's why I'm saying it is fundamentally flawed, that concept. So what we're saying, in addition to people going right to the Constitutional Court, and I'm telling you, you cannot dispute that if somebody has a case, they will be left in this country. Now we say even if they lose there, we still give them another bite at the cherry, and we give them independent arbitration that will determine it. So it is discretionary but subject to administrative justice. And as the minister might give reasons for why he refuses the case, it can be challenged and so on, so it's subject to administrative justice by an independent tribunal, not by the minister. He's not going to decide whether it's real or not. An independent party will overrule him if he acts arbitrarily.
I would like us to have this debate, because I will suggest also Honorable Lewis to read a recent argument, 2015, by the Association of Southeast Asian Nations on this matter. So the debate is not cast in stone because of the European Department of America on the question. The debate internationally is about unity in a concrete argument. Because I'm reading it through, and they're referring and heading to the strength of South Africa. They quoted South Africa here as one of the countries that are moving. So I would suggest that in fact we consult the European Parliament.
Thank you. I think that we're not going to continue on this path. I agree. I think we should part this issue until we have a full contingent of members, and then we can raise it again. Obviously, it will be raised again next week. So section, 12.5 is another contentious issue. Okay, we'll move now to section 13. Subsection 2 in a minute. Okay, there's 2 points there. Just hold on. This is a consequential amendment from previous amendments. So are we agreed on this?
Subsection B allows the minister basically to regulate whatever he or she likes in relation to this act, and to either add and significantly, substantively alter what is said in the Act, or to add a whole lot of new requirements or stipulations is far too broad and wide-ranging and open-ended. I would suggest that we delete that clause B and leave it as A. That is the power that the minister has. He has the power to regulate on any matter that is prescribed in certain Act. He doesn't have any other powers besides that. DG?
That's fine.
Okay, so is there any other opinion from Parliament?
As you said, I'll be brief. May I suggest with respect to that paragraph B, superior time. If we, by way of analogy, refer to the number of statutes or acts passed in Parliament, we will see a very, very similar kind of enabling provision allowing the minister to make these kind of regulations. And can we just, before I close down, have a look at the exact wording of B. It does not give the minister a wide discretionary power to make any kind of regulation that he or she might like. It gives the alien power to make a regulation which may in fact be necessary. Expedient may be something slightly else, but a regulation that will be necessary in order to achieve the purposes of the Act. So there is a scope in the ambit, and it's not a discretionary, unfettered, wide power. May I, with great respect to my principles, I think we should maybe reconsider the deletion of the subsection.
Okay, come here and then Honourable Holders.
And I just want to ask, is the deletion of that sentence going to make any satisfaction? Do you think that one is?
Honourable Holders? Well, you covered, okay. Honourable, add it small.
Yes, Chair, not to delay with me further, certainly concur with my colleague and his title. Chair, this provision was tested in courts, and the way it's crafted here now has been gone through many, many federal advisors, and we obtained it accessible now in the courts as it stands there. So the minister doesn't have unfettered powers, Chair, it is restricted to the Act itself. So I would also request that this remains the same, Chair. Thank you.
Sorry. B.
to the DG. The legal.
See, if I'm not mistaken, I think the question will address to me, if you would allow me. If we only retain what is in paragraph A, say any matter which may or must be prescribed in terms of this Act, so that would require an exact enabling provision in this Act empowering the Minister to make that regulation. If that exact enabling provision is not in the statute, the powers of the Minister with respect will be curtailed in the sense that if there is another regulation that has to be made, not maybe specifically prescribed in the Act, but in order to achieve the very purposes of this Act, the hand of the Minister would be tied in making that regulation.
Honourable Lewis, Chairperson, it is exactly our intention to curtail the powers of the Minister to that which is not
our intention.
It is exactly our intention to curtail the powers of the Minister to that which is contained in the Act advocate. You're suggesting that we should afford the Minister powers to things which are not in the Act, which are not prescribed in the Act. That is outrageous. I don't care if it's been tested in a court. The problem with so many laws passed by this Parliament is they give unfettered power to the Minister to regulate on whatever he or she wishes to regulate, as long as it's in pursuit, in broad pursuit of whatever the objectives of the applicable legislation may be. I do not believe that that is the right way to write legislation. This Parliament must decide what power it lends to the Minister to be able to act within the ambit of the legislation we are passing. Otherwise, we must just abdicate our legislative function to the executive as well, and let them regulate on whatever they wish to regulate.
Okay, there's no need for that. Thank you.
What's a serious point?
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think, you know, the way I look at D is that he will be able to regulate, but he can only regulate to achieve the purpose of the Act. So if he goes outside that, he will be challenged.
Yeah.
But my question is, can we take out the word expedient? Will that assist a little bit and just see whether the word may be necessary?
If my principles have this with you, I've got no qualms whatsoever, as a matter of expediency. But where it is necessary to achieve a purpose of this Act, the scope and the ambit is there, with all due respect, great respect for the Honourable Lewis, that is not an unfettered ministerial power. I'm done, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Elvis.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to ask a question for clarity. This is part of the law that I'm not really familiar with. If the legal advisors can just tell us how the courts approach a situation where they would look at a regulation issued by the Minister and then measure it against the purpose of the Act to see whether it falls within the scope or not. Thank you.
That's fair.
Chair, once again, I'll be very brief. Honourable Hillers, it's quite correct to say that, and I'm saying this with respect as well, that political functionaries should not be allowed to become lawmakers onto their own. That is a well-respected principle if we have a look at judicial decision-making in this regard. So in reviewing, for instance, a ministerial regulation, the court would have, first of all, a specific view of where is the Minister enabled in this Act to make a regulation. In the case of B, that would not necessarily be the case. But if the court is satisfied that the ministerial regulation that has been made in a reasonable manner within the scope and ambit of the purpose of this Act, the court in all likelihood would not set aside the regulation. Because what does it do? It meets one of the objectives of this Act, if you have a look at the whole scope and end of the broad scope of the Act.
Honourable Mahersa.
You know, one of the problems that certainly the electorate feel is that politicians are not accountable for their actions. not accountable to the electorate that they are supposed to serve, or the interests of the country. Such regulations or such clauses like this feed into that narrative that the minister, without subject to Collins' approval, or this committee that is the oversight of the minister, can gazette or regulate whatever he or she may feel necessary or deem necessary to achieve the objectives of the Act, which may or may not, in fact, be contrary to the provisions of the Act. Now, we cannot have a situation where ministers have, and as the Honourable Peel looks quite right, untested power to surpass the right for Parliament to hold them accountable. If he or she believes that there is something that needs to be added or deleted from the Act, they must come back to Parliament with an amendment to the Act, and that can then be debated. But we cannot abdicate our responsibility in oversight to Parliament, to the Republic, and to the electorate, to the minister, which they can then, put up in their offices in Plain Street. It's just simply not acceptable. And we have seen the continued abuse of prime ministers to gazette whatever they want with no subject to authority by Parliament. So, as this stands now,
we should probably use the word abuse by ministers in this
country. It has been abused.
Anyway, so when it has been... Yes.
And the courts have found that the power has been abused. I mean, we have to now try and protect the executive. That is not your job, Chair, is to protect the
executive. Thank you, but my job is to...
That is not to protect
the executive committee, and your point has been noted, so thank you very much.
I'm not...
Now, when we... Well, I'm moving.
Our point is not finished, Chair. If you want to share, you need to share properly.
Your point
is finished. You can't share on a biased partisan matter.
No, what I'm saying is, please,
when my time is finished,
please just listen to me. What we've done is, we've all discussed this matter quite in depth. Everybody's discussed it. The legal fraternity have discussed it, but everybody's discussed it. And we're not moving forward. We know what your position is. You want this to be removed. That is your position. That's your position. You know what the position of the other parties are. So we can't move forward without just going round and round and round. So what I would suggest is that we park this, and when we have a full contingent of members next week, we can come back to this clause. Honourable Conley and then Honourable Hilder.
I agree with that, Tiberin, but I have just wanted to add something. A very important thing on the role of Parliament in the legislature. And I think maybe we need to debate that also. Whether accountability means shall we be there. So I don't have to end him to debate now. But if we can play the fight out of that, you know, because we might be having different understanding one or another. Sure.
Okay. Chair, thank you. Firstly, a request, if the advocate could provide the court judgment that he is referring to, which have tested this matter and have ruled that it does not provide unfettered power to ministers, I would like to read them, please. And not just one, if you provide us with a selection of those court judgments. Secondly, Chair, I may be willing to consider if the regulations contemplated in subsection B came back to this committee for approval before their gazetting, because I think ultimately when we are giving ministers such fine power, it has to be subject to the legislature. We cannot be just giving the ministers such wide powers. If you read section four of the Act, the purpose of the Act, which is referred to in this clause. Anyway, I think the clause should actually refer to Section 4, not just the purposes of this Act. It implies that the minister can regulate what he deems to be in the public interest. It implies he can regulate what he deems or she deems to be the rights and obligations of investors. Those are very broad matters that are not... For the minister to decide politically or arbitrarily. They are called the legislature to decide by elected representatives sitting in committee and the powers conferred upon this legislature. It is not for the minister to decide those things.
Thank you. So we'll just park that. Another one, section 13B. Okay, we move to section 14 now. There's nothing in 14. Yes.
I deeply read this document from Anglo American, and they're making quite a valid point to say that this legislation is not harmonized with the SADC investment agenda. Now, we might just put that into the transitional arrangement clause, like we did with the BITS, you know, we might refer to that. And I had a good discussion with Professor Don around it. So maybe they can come back and see how we can bring that in.
Okay, what we're doing with that is also, because we got it late, that'll be discussed next week, but absolutely. Okay, so now 14, there's no issues, sorry.
Okay,
I just want to ask a question for clarity. I did not, it's based on information I did not have before. Just in subclause 2, any investments made under the nation's treaties before promulgation of this act will be governed by the general South African law. What happens in a case where there's an ending of a bid, but there are certain provisions in a bid that when you end it, you know, it will continue to run for 30 years onwards or something to that effect, or some bids have that, I'm not sure if all of them have that. How will that be, I would treat that with regards to subsection 2. As it says then, if a bid has been terminated, then South African law will be applicable, but then it keeps on running for many years. So I suppose my inference would be that the bid would continue to run, and after 20 years have ended, then the South African law would be applicable if there's a gap in between promulgation of this law and the ending of the bid. Thank you very much.
EDG.
Chair, that is provided for in 14.1. Where we are referring specifically to the bid. So those provisions will continue, those advisory clauses will continue until it terminates. So we covered the concern that is raised by the Honourable Member under 41.
Honourable Lewis? Yeah. Chairman, what about bids that have not been terminated? So, I mean, there's a whole lot of bids, for example, our bids with China, which has not yet been terminated, and there's no indication that it will be terminated. So are investments made under that bid covered by the bid or by this legislation?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the objective of this Act is very clear. It is to regulate the law in South Africa. And this particular transitional clause was crafted in such a way as to recognize existing international agreements. So if there is a bid in place, whether it's terminated or not, whether there is a so-called transitional clause that protects investments after termination, it will not interfere with the operation of those. And I think the magic words here are existing and new investments. So once a bid is terminated, there is a period during which the bid will still exist, but only for investments made prior to termination. If any investments are made after termination, and of course, in the absence of this act being promulgated, general South African law will apply. So we don't believe that there's any contradiction in subsections 1 and 2 as provided for now.
I mean, I think the general legal principle would apply that whatever obligations we have as a country, or whatever rights somebody has, that continues. And therefore, as I said, because in all laws, never clean slate. So that is why you have the transitional arrangements to spell that out. But the general law will apply. Somebody has an existing right, for example, the grandfather clauses, where they are protected for the next 20 years, they are protected for the next 20 years. And this law cannot override that international right or the obligation we have as a state.
You know that
that's true, but
now you can talk for both of the rest. Oh, you covered. Thank you. Okay, we're moving now to section 15.
which is just the short title and commencement, and it's green, so it's basically the removal of the word promotion and from the bill. No problems there? Can we, if we agree, can we please say so?
I don't get it.
Thank you. Okay, so we've come to the end of it for today, but I just want to go back about the way forward. The members should study the Anglo-American input so that we can formulate position. I'd also like to request Advocate Ellis to submit his concerns with Clause 5 in writing. You don't know what we're talking about. Thank you. And then the flag clauses that we picked up today was Clause 9, Clause 12.2c, Clause 12.5. Yes, that's it. And 13b. Okay. And that's what we'll come back to next week. Sorry, can you talk into your microphone now?
The SADC investment agenda. Yes. That might include something. I think it's 14.
No.
Okay. No. Thank you. Okay, thank you very much, members. This meeting is adjourned.
Oh, yes, it's very important. John, what time do you think you're going to do? That's enough.
So if this act must apply,